You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ice cover on the Great Lakes has been going down in recent years. We'll talk to the creator of a big new project looking at the lakes in the winter. Now, more hikers are trying to complete thru-hikes of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail. The 1,000-mile journey is a big accomplishment. Fewer people have attempted to finish all 11 National Scenic Trails in the United States. Our next guest accomplished that goal last week when she walked the final steps of the Ice Age Trail in Sturgeon Bay. Arlette Lahn is a hiking guide with Red Lion Guiding in New Hampshire. She's now the first known female hiker to complete all the National Scenic Trails. In the hiking world, her trail name is Apple Pie. Arlette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Now, you obviously love hiking. When did you get the idea to say, all right, I'm going to do all the scenic trails around the country?
So I started hiking, long-distance hiking, in 2003 in California on the Pacific Crest Trail. And just slowly kind of hiked trails that I wanted to hike. And then I found out there was more and more trails. And then there's National Scenic Trails and a whole list of them. And then I talked to this gentleman. His trail name is Nimble Will Nomad. And he was like, wow, you only have like four left to complete them all. And that was in 2018. And I was like, oh, maybe I should finish them all. And he's like, yeah, you could be the first woman to do them all. I'm like, that'd be kind of cool. So then I was looking at which ones I had left, and I started to tackle those. And I mean, one of the longest ones, the North Country Trail, was in there, and that was a hard one to do. But then I started working on finishing them up, and then the Ice Age Trail was the last one, and I just finished that up, Monday? Yeah, last week.
Now, I'll admit, I'm a more modest kind of hiker. I'll do a couple-hour loop here and there. Can you talk about the joy of doing this kind of longer-term end-to-end hike?
For me, what is very appealing about it is it's you see something new every day. And I like the routine of having, you get up, you pack up your gear, you go hike. You just think about where's my food, where's my water, and where is my next flat spot to camp. But you do get to see something new every day. So for me, that's like a perfect combination of, things that I really enjoy is discovery, but also having that little safety of my little routine and having everything that I need with me. So it's like ideal.
Now, the Ice Age Trail here in Wisconsin, this was the last one. This is the one that completed it for you. I'm not going to say you saved the best for last, but can you share some of the things that you saw, the things you liked about the Ice Age Trail?
I liked that I learned a lot about the glaciers. I mean, like up here where I live near New Hampshire, there's all the boulders and the glacial erratics and all of that. But then on the Ice Age Trail, they make such a focus out of it. Then like have like little displays where it talks about it, or in the guidebook or the maps, it talks about it. So I actually read a little bit more into it. It was like, oh, these potholes are all like formed by these glacial boulders, and there's these eskers. And so you learn a little bit more about it. And that was interesting to me.
What kind of preparation goes into planning out a big through hike?
Depending on the hikes, there is more or less available online. The most important things are finding out where your resupply is. So where can I get my next supply of food? And some trails, you have to send yourself packages along the way because there is no store, but there's a post office. Or you have to hitchhike to another town to get to a post office because I'm not going to carry like 150 miles worth of food. I mean, I could, but it gets really heavy, you know? So that kind of logistical planning is the hardest part. And then after that, it's kind of like micro planning. It's like, where's my next tent site and, you know, and all of that stuff, or where's my next water? All of those things. But the first thing to me is like, how many towns are there and where are they? And do I need to mail myself something?
And part of the fun, I think, of hiking like this is maybe a solitary activity, but it sounds like you've gotten to meet a lot of people along the way, other hikers, people in the communities you hike through or past. Do you have some favorite memories?
Yeah, and it depends on the hikes, right? Like, so some of the more popular hikes, you'll see a lot of hikers on the trail. Some of the less popular hikes with through hikers, like the Ice Age Trail, there's more section hikers on it. So I actually really enjoyed meeting people along the way and that were section hiking. And then luckily, like, I ran into two sets of women that were like, hey, we live a little bit further along the trail. And so when you come where we live, you can come and hang out at our house, and we'll do your laundry and we'll cook for you. And so I got to know more people that live in the areas versus the transient hiker that I am myself. So it was a different connection that I had on the Ice Age Trail. I got to meet more of the locals, which has been a welcome addition to that hiking experience.
And Arlette, as we wrap up, I've got a hunch I know the answer, but having done this big hike, are you going to take a break from hiking for a while?
Not really. I went hiking on Saturday in the White Mountains.
Arlette, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
You're welcome.
Arlette Lahn, trail name Apple Pie, recently finished her through hike of the Ice Age Trail, becoming the first woman known to have hiked all 11 national scenic trails in the United States. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about being pregnant during the pandemic.
The pandemic has been hard on many parents. For Njeme Russell Kamara of Milwaukee, her parenting started earlier than she expected when a pregnancy-related illness sent her to the emergency room during the height of the pandemic. Russell Kamara shares her experience as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
Every time I'd heard someone who was pregnant experience something that was so severe, I would say to myself, oh God, that sucks. That better not happen to me. And as soon as I said that, it did. I was in lockdown. And for context, this was the time before vaccines, when people were hogging toilet paper and washing their groceries. Anyway, while working two new jobs from home, I was so nauseous and throwing up every day from week 7 to week 22. My nutrient levels are all over the place. And it's winter time too, which means windows are closed. Every smell is exacerbated, and all I want to do is go anywhere and get fresh air. And I can't because we're in a pandemic and we don't know where the virus is coming from. And given that I had a miscarriage prior, I did not want to risk getting sick. So around week 14, I was listening to a podcast with Amy Schumer, and she was talking about hyperemesis gravidarum and how she landed in the hospital. And I thought, that's not going to happen to me. Well, around week 21, I didn't get enough hydration that morning after being sick the night prior. I turn on the shower, waiting for the water to heat up, and I tell my husband, babe, I'm not feeling good. I had said this so many times before, and all of a sudden, I fall and pass out in his arms, tongue in cheek. And when I come to, I'm on the floor and he's gently slapping me and splashing water in my face. Immediately, we go to the hospital. We're both anxious because that is the last place we wanted to go. We'd gotten so far and staying away from people who could be carrying COVID to now land in that spot with them. And I was so angry, but anxious because I needed to make sure that our baby was okay and that I was okay. We're sitting in the ER by the windows, finding a seat by the outskirts of a full room. And we're waiting for over 2 hours just to have a bed. Why? Because there were so many COVID patients, there was not enough room for the rest of us. Meanwhile, a woman is vomiting next to me in a paper bag, and it made me nauseous. I can see it, and I still don't know who next to me has COVID. A nurse calls me twice to go into the back room just to check my vitals. Still, I wasn't seen by a doctor, and that cycle happens again. And every time I go back to my seat in the waiting room, I'm paranoid walking through the sea of sick people. Finally, they call my name at the 3-hour mark. I get a bed, and they infuse me with one of those liter bags. I didn't have to pee for a long time. That's how dehydrated I was. They checked my baby's heartbeat, and she was healthy. And long story short, we did not get COVID that day. Today, we're at a time where there are boosters and more boosters, but for many parents, the pandemic is still stressful. Even though my daughter hadn't been born yet, my parenting had already started by doing what I needed to do to protect my health and my mind and my spirit. Yeah, I sure celebrated Mother's Day that May. I mean, even though she wasn't in my arms yet, we had made it so far. And that was worth celebrating.
And Jaime Russell Kamara of Milwaukee shared her story of being pregnant during the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a lake expert tells us about his research studying ice decline in the Great Lakes and what it means for life in and near the water. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Ice coverage on the Great Lakes has declined by 71% between the 1970s and 2010s, according to the International Joint Commission. Researchers say that climate change is to blame for the declining ice, which is affecting not only fish and other lake species, but also humans. A big new project called the Winter Grab aimed to measure the impact of changing conditions on the Great Lakes. Ted Ozerski is a large lake biological limnologist and associate professor in the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He organized Winter Grab and the Great Lakes Winter Network. Ted, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the ice cover issue, tell us about the Winter Grab. This is a big project bringing together a lot of researchers. Tell us about the origins.
Yeah, for sure. So it turns out we don't know very much about winter on the Great Lakes. It's sort of a bit of a mystery about what the Great Lakes do between November and, let's say, March. So last year, we came together with a bunch of researchers working on different aspects of the Great Lakes ecosystem, and we got some funding from the Cooperative Institute for Great Lakes Research to organize this collaborative sampling campaign. And the Winter Grab was basically an effort by something like 19 organizations in the U.S. and Canada, where over the course of 10 days this past February, all these different groups went to a bunch of different sites around the Great Lakes and collected standardized kinds of samples to understand what the chemistry, physics, and biology of the Great Lakes look like when they're covered by ice.
My understanding is that we used to think that the important stuff in lakes happened from spring to fall, and winter, there's just kind of like in a holding pattern. Turns out, no. Can you talk about what is going on in the lakes in the winter that's important to ecosystems?
Yeah, for sure. So a few things are different about winter than summer. Of course, it's much colder than in the summer. But the other big change that ice cover brings is the amount of light that's reaching the surface of the water. So there's a lot less light in the winter, and that slows some things down that are reliant on that light. But it also, surprisingly, sort of other things are keep chugging along during the winter. Some of the things that are interesting that are happening during the winter are, for example, things like productivity of some algae species that are adapted to this cold water conditions that it turns out are actually high quality food for some of the critters that live in the lakes. Some of the fish reproduce during the winter, so that's important for some of the fish species that are economically important. Sort of connections between the water column and the sediment and where the invasive dracinid mussels live are affected by winter conditions as well.
So if we have less ice cover, and it sounds like it has been going down over the decades, what kind of worries does that raise for you?
Yeah, so there's a number of things that people are worried about with declining ice cover. And a lot of these worries are sort of just that, because we really don't know enough about winter to make these projections about what the future will look like with less winter. Some of the concerns around winter is that things like cyanobacterial harmful blooms are going to increase in severity during the summer months. Other concerns have to do with fish. So, for example, there are studies from Lake Michigan and from Lake Erie that show that these warmer, less icy winters affect the reproduction of species like yellow perch and whitefish. But ultimately, really, we don't know quite enough about winter to make these sort of solid projections about what the future holds for us. And that was one of the sort of objectives of Winter Grab, and this increasing interest in winter research is to try and close some of these information gaps that we have about winter.
We're talking to Ted Ozersky from the University of Minnesota Duluth. He studies large lake ecosystems, including the Great Lakes, part of a big winter grab project, trying to learn more about what winter means for the Great Lakes and the possible impacts in the future of declining ice cover over the decades. Ted, what surprised you the most out of the data you've pulled together so far from the big winter grab?
I think the thing that surprised me the most is how different parts of the Great Lakes are in the winter. We know that, for example, Lake Superior is quite different from Lake Erie during the summertime. But you might think that in the winter, where things are so cold and there is less light, the lakes might be more similar to each other with less biology going on. But still, they're very, very different. There's a lot of difference in the water chemistry, and there are big differences in the biology as well. And one of the things that these big differences are suggesting is that there is still a lot of exciting biology happening during the winter and under the ice.
Are you hoping to do something like this again so you can start to see change over time in the winter?
That's a great question, Rob. And that's definitely something that we're talking about with our collaborators at the Great Lakes sort of winter network. This winter grab effort was a one-time project. So we got some funding from the Cooperative Institute for Great Lakes Research to do this. But we're definitely hoping that we can, like you say, do this again and sort of start monitoring this change over time. So we're sort of exploring how we can do this again.
Now, I mentioned that statistic at the outset, 70% or so decline in ice coverage in the Great Lake. This is from averages in the 1970s to the 2010s. I mean, that sounds really big. Are we seeing that much less ice over time?
One of the interesting things about ice on the Great Lakes is how variable it is from year to year. Even before climate change, a very small difference in air temperature from winter to winter would have a big difference. It is very variable. If you look at this graph, you know, you can have 90% ice cover on Lake Superior in 1 year and then 10% ice cover in another year. But if you look at the overall long-term trend, the trend is definitely towards decreasing ice cover. And the change, like you mentioned with this statistic, is pretty dramatic.
Do you have hopes that climate change can be slowed down enough so that that trend line doesn't continue over the next couple of decades?
That's a good question. I think I have hope, but given our current trajectories and some of the modeling that I've seen for the Great Lakes, it looks pretty likely that by the end of the 21st century, ice cover will be a very rare event on the Great Lakes. So unless something very dramatic changes, I think we're going to keep seeing less and less ice until it almost completely disappears.
As you mentioned, this is a big question mark. If ice cover keeps going down, what it's going to mean for so many of the species we're familiar with, maybe on fish fry, among other things. What are some of the big open questions that you have that you're going to be looking at over the next couple of years when it comes to the impact of declining ice?
I think one of the big open questions, really, in terms of biology, in terms of physics, in terms of chemistry of the Great Lakes, is what does ice itself, the presence of ice and the properties of ice, do for the ecosystem? So here, a lot of the people who are involved, were involved in the winter grab, they're coming from different disciplines. Some of them are physicists, some of them are chemists, some of them are biologists. And sort of the big unifying question is, well, what does it mean if we have no ice, or if we have, you know, 1 month less of ice? So that's, I think, what collectively we are most curious about with this winter work. For me, some of the questions that I'm really interested in is, what does the presence or absence of ice do for the productivity of the Great Lakes in terms of, for example, the growth of phytoplankton or some of the critters that form the base of the food web?
I want to get a sense of what practically was happening over this couple of weeks in winter grab. I understand some of it was really high-tech stuff and some of it, you know, was buckets. Can you talk about the range of activities you did to collect all this data?
For sure. So we created a common protocol for the things that we wanted all the participants to try and collect, and sort of had some safety guidance on how to work in the winter. But it was up to the individual teams to decide where they were going to go and how they're actually going to do the collection. So like you said, it sort of ranged from some people sampling, from a pier using a bucket to some people using an airboat to sample locations in Saginaw Bay, people using snowmobiles, And then some teams worked with the U.S. Coast Guard to collect samples from Coast Guard icebreakers. So it was a pretty big range.
And then you're in Duluth. You're no stranger to cold. But can you talk about, you know, being out on the lakes in the middle, Lake Superior in particular, in the middle of winter, collecting all this stuff?
You know, in some ways, winter work is less challenging than summer work, at least if you have good ice cover, because in the winter you can either drive out if the ice is really thick or sort of walk out on the ice and, you know, set up your ice shelter. And it's actually pretty comfortable and cozy. So you don't have to deal with waves. You don't have to trailer a boat. So if the weather cooperates and it's not too bad, I actually prefer working in the winter than in the summer. But of course, worst case scenario is it's a whiteout blizzard and you just don't want to be out there.
Ted, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Ted Ozerski, a large lake biological limnologist and associate professor in the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Wisconsin, Duluth. Ted joined us to talk about his research with Winter Grab, studying the decline of ice coverage on the Great Lakes, a big effort all over the Great Lakes to collect data about species and ecosystems in the lakes. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new book tells the story of lesser-known figures in American labor history and the impact they had on modern workplaces. Meet the author of Fight Like Hell. And gas prices have gone back down over the last couple of weeks, but they're still high. We'll get the latest on oil, gas, and the impact on inflation. By the way, earlier we talked to someone who'd hiked the Ice Age Trail and all the scenic trails around the U.S. Want to hear your favorite place to hike in Wisconsin? Email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'll share your answers tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a reproductive law expert joins the show to tell us why fetal personhood might be the next big chapter of the abortion debate. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden is returning from a four-day diplomatic trip to the Middle East. We'll talk to a foreign affairs reporter about the impact of his talks with leaders from around the region. First, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last month, some abortion opponents are renewing their focus on what's called fetal personhood. The movement's goal is to recognize the unborn as people under the law, granting them a right to life. Some legal experts say there are big legal and practical issues with fetal personhood, including making it possible to criminalize the actions of pregnant people. Personhood bills have been introduced in at least six states so far this year, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which supports abortion rights. An Arizona fetal personhood law was blocked in federal court last week. In 2020, a group of Wisconsin Republican lawmakers introduced a constitutional amendment that would grant fetal personhood in the state, but that amendment failed to move forward. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of fetal personhood? Do you want that law to come into existence here in Wisconsin, nationwide? What questions do you have about what it would mean for pregnant women in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is an expert on the law, history, and politics of reproduction and the debate over abortion in the United States. Her latest book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. She's a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk more about what fetal personhood would mean in practice?
Well, one of the, I think, interesting questions is we don't know entirely, right? There are different versions of fetal personhood that can be written into the law. The most basic premise of personhood is basically that abortion itself is unconstitutional. So if there were a personhood law in Wisconsin or a personhood law nationally or the Supreme Court recognized personhood, that would mean that states no longer would have the ability to say that they wanted abortion to be legal. Voters, you know, if you went directly to voters, would no longer be able to say they wanted abortion to be legal. It would essentially create a right, a fetal right that states and voters couldn't override. What else it would mean is more uncertain. most states or folks who've defined personhood have described it as, you know, life beginning at fertilization and rights kicking in at fertilization. That raises interesting questions about whether some contraceptives would be banned, about whether the practice of infertility treatments would have to change fundamentally when we're thinking about things like in vitro fertilization or the storage of embryos. It may even mean changes to how census data are taken, how dependents are defined on tax returns, who's owed child support. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Let's talk some about the timing here. As this is the phrase is usually fetal personhood. As I understand it, a fetus isn't defined until like the 11th week of pregnancy. Before that, it's an embryo. Before that, it's a zygote. When people talk about passing laws like this, though, as you just mentioned, do they usually mean at conception?
Yes. Yeah, that's usually the argument, right? And to the extent states have started using explicit definitions of personhood, it's often at fertilization. There are exceptions to that. So you may remember around 2019, a variety of states across the South and Midwest banned abortion at 6 weeks on the theory that that's when fetal heartbeat or fetal cardiac activity could be detected. Georgia actually created fetal rights and personhood at 6 weeks as an extension of that law. But most, I think, generally within the anti-abortion movement in many states that are trying to move on personhood, it's fertilization of an egg when personhood begins.
And the fertilization, I mean, this is implantation happens, again, as I understand it, 6 to 12 days after that. Fertilization is a very narrow, I guess, definition here. Can you talk about the impact that could have in particular, that window between fertilization and implantation on things like, as you mentioned, what we generally consider as birth control?
Right. So there's a dispute about how some common contraceptives actually work. So there are kind of two levels of disagreement here. One is a disagreement about when personhood begins and or what abortion means. And another is a disagreement about how specific drugs actually work. So IUDs and emergency contraceptives are believed by some to prevent the implantation of a fertilized egg, which would make those abortifacients or make those violative of fetal rights, according to people who believe that. There are some folks who also think that even the birth control pill prevents implantation of a fertilized egg. It's worth emphasizing that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists disagrees with all of that and says that both, you know, emergency contraceptives and the birth control pill and IUDs work by preventing or delaying ovulation, not by preventing implantation. But because many believe that it does prevent implantation, that could result in these laws applying to birth control methods or what we often think of as birth control methods.
We're talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at the University of California, Davis, looking at the idea of fetal personhood laws, defining under, say, state constitutions in some instances, that life would begin at conception and grant a certain battery of rights to the zygote, the embryo, the fetus along the way, limiting abortion and raising a lot of legal questions along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your calls, with your questions for our guest. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Deborah is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. Personhood for fetuses is like the height of hypocrisy because they don't really care about life. It's about controlling women. It's about misogyny and patriarchy. And that's pretty much my comment.
Deborah, thanks for the call. Mary, Deborah raises a question. She raises the concern of control over women. And people who are worried about fetal personhood laws say, well, wait, what power is that going to give, say, a state to regulate the activities of a pregnant woman? What kind of, again, we don't have these laws in place now. What kind of concerns are out there?
Well, I mean, I think that the people who are the wing of the anti-abortion movement that's the most invested in the idea of actually punishing pregnant women. So in other words, most state laws now focus on punishing doctors. And that's true in Wisconsin as well as elsewhere. States that have more recent abortion bans than Wisconsin's, which is obviously an older law, had maybe expanded that to include a broad group of folks defined as accomplices. So think about, you know, the mom driving her daughter to an appointment or somebody donating to an abortion fund, but they still don't reach the patient. The people who are pushing to criminalize the patient are the people who say, you know, personhood requires absolute equal treatment of a fetus or zygote or embryo and anybody else. So in other words, if it would be a crime to intentionally kill, you know, a 10-year-old or a 30-year-old, it should be the same kind of crime, meaning a homicide, to have an abortion. And the person that should extend not only to the doctor, but to the person choosing the abortion. So I think there's a fear for some that the more personhood is recognized, the more not only you'll have the kind of control over women's lives, you know, that arguably comes with any abortion ban, you also would have direct efforts to punish women, which is not a guarantee, but it's certainly true that the people who are the what are called the abortion abolitionists, the people who push that argument on kind of strict equal treatment the most, are also the people who are calling for the punishment of women and other people who are pregnant.
Another concern I've seen raised is, say, in the instance of someone who's pregnant and is diagnosed with cancer, if a cancer treatment would put the fetus, say, at risk along the way, would they then have to delay chemotherapy, radiation treatment, that kind of thing?
Yeah, potentially, right? And I mean, you wouldn't even need personhood to get to that. This really depends on the scope of the life of the pregnant person exceptions or life of the mother exceptions that exist in state laws. Wisconsin Right to Life, my understanding, is opposed to such exceptions on the ground that there are no scenarios, according to the group, in which abortion is life-saving. They tend to argue that abortion is the intentional taking of a fetal life. So if you just happen to have a fetus or an unborn child or an embryo die because you're trying to save somebody's life and you're making, as they would put it, every reasonable effort to save the fetal life, sometimes things happen. But this idea of no intentional taking a fetal life ever, even to save somebody else's life, is a shift and could affect access to a variety of treatment, right? It could mean delays. It could mean lack of access to treatment for patients who are pregnant in a variety of settings, right? Not, as you mentioned, not just people who are seeking abortions, but people who are pregnant who are getting other kinds of treatment.
We're talking to Mary Ziegler, professor of law at the University of California, Davis, and expert on reproductive law, with us today for a closer look at the fetal personhood movement, what it can mean for families, healthcare, birth control, and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this idea of fetal personhood? Would you want to see it become a part of the Constitution in Wisconsin, part of the United States Constitution? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about fetal personhood, some of the legal and practical implications of granting personhood status starting at conception, where the movement stands with the constitutional right to an abortion overturned now. Law professor Mary Ziegler at the University of California, Davis, is with us, and you can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rob is with us in La Crosse. Hi, Rob. Are you there, Rob?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, there you are. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And nope, I think we lost Rob. Thanks for trying, though. We'll go to Loretta then in Wausau. Loretta, hi.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I wanted to say I do not think that abortion should be criminalized, but I also think that life does begin at conception. It's biologically and philosophically, it's life, and it's none other than human life according to its DNA. But it's the mother's unique moral situation to decide what to do about that pregnancy.
Loretta, Loretta, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your thoughts. Mary Loretta reminding me that a lot of people have nuanced opinions on abortion, not all pro or con, some gray areas for people. What do you think of what Loretta had to say?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me, Americans United for Life did a poll with YouGov recently on fetal rights and basically asked Americans, you know, are you supportive of some kind of protections for life in the womb? And they found a majority of people said yes. And then they said, are you also supportive of restrictions on abortion? And they found that the number of people who responded yes to that question was much, much lower than the people who said, I want some kind of protection for life. And all of that goes to show that even if you think that, you know, that personhood begins at fertilization, or even, you know, not just life, maybe even some kind of rights begin at fertilization, that doesn't necessarily mean you support criminalizing abortion. Those two things in recent history have gone together, but I mean, that was neither historically inevitable, and it still really isn't. So Loretta's comment reminded me of that.
Loretta, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tate joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tate.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just have a question, because I know for everyone you talk to, you're going to get a different answer on when life actually begins. But as from the perspective of our government, don't you have to be born to get a Social Security number? So why wouldn't, from a legal point of view, that be when the individual life begins at birth?
Tate, thanks for the call. Mary, Social Security numbers for people this is a question that has come up. Would people need to get Social Security numbers before they're born?
Yeah, well, one interesting thing, obviously, about Roe being overturned is it throws this question to individual states. And so, you know, Arizona, which already has a personhood measure, as you mentioned, has a different definition of when personhood begins and when certain rights attach that may be in tension with the one that the Social Security Administration has in the federal government. So it also opens up interesting and complicated possibilities about, you know, what happens when federal definitions of personhood clash with state personhood definitions. And when do we think the federal government was trying to, you know, kind of take precedence, and when do we think they weren't? And I mean, we don't really know how those kinds of conflicts will be resolved, because Roe v. Wade had settled this for so many years that we have a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of legal gray areas.
Tate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Danny is with us now in Waukon, Iowa. Danny, hi.
Hi there. This kind of might have been touched on by your last caller, but I was curious if life and, say, personhood begins at conception, at what point can the mother start collecting child support payments from the father, if that's an issue? And also, if they have a Social Security number, are they able to be claimed on the mother's tax return and get the child tax credit before they're born and things like that?
Danny, thanks for the call. Big open questions, Mary.
Yeah, I mean, these, again, are things that are not really very well addressed. So in some states that have defined personhood, as I mentioned, Georgia has this thing that kicks in at 6 weeks. Georgia lawmakers have explicitly said, by the way, we do mean that this kicks in for the purposes of child support and taxes and the census. So we know that in Georgia, if that law goes into effect, it would at least cover those things. The problem, of course, is that states, if it's just left up to the states can define personhood or constitutional personhood however they want. And they may, as many states have, just have some sort of free-floating idea that personhood and rights begin at fertilization without spelling out what that means for anything like child support or the census or taxes. So I think often you just sort of have to stay tuned, unless it's a case like Georgia's. And I don't mean to make Georgia sound as if it's dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's either. It's just they've spelled out a handful of ramifications while leaving a lot of the rest, you know, to be determined.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at the University of California, Davis, about the concept of fetal personhood, what it means for abortion, but not just abortion, as we're hearing a lot of other legal changes, a lot of legal consequences if these laws start coming into effect around the country. Kate joins us now in Madison. Kate, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for calling. I just had a question since we had a legal scholar on the line. So I'm a person, too. I'm a person that can get pregnant. Isn't it discriminatory if I don't receive life-saving care, but somebody else who cannot get pregnant is allowed to receive life-saving care?
Kate, thanks.
Yeah, that's it.
Go ahead, Mary.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, so yes, I think that's correct. We know under federal law that, you know, pregnancy discrimination is a violation of federal civil rights law. It counts as a form of sex discrimination. And in fact, you know, there have been some signs that the Justice Department is going to vigorously take this position. We know that when pharmacists, for example, have been refusing medications to people because they're pregnant on the theory that they may be used for abortions, the Justice Department is taking the position that that's a civil rights violation. That's a form of discrimination. You can make the same argument with respect to life-saving medical treatment. You know, essentially the idea that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy is, you know, unconstitutional or is a violation of basic principles of equality on the basis of sex and other things. Having said all that, I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court buys that argument. The court had said in the 70s that pregnancy discrimination for the purposes of the Constitution, right, not for federal civil rights law, is not unconstitutional, right, that pregnancy discrimination is not sex discrimination and is okay from a constitutional standpoint. And the court, I think, has tried to say states have an interest in protecting fetal life that justifies treating pregnant people differently from other people, even potentially, although the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on this, when it comes to life-saving care. So I think the answer legally depends on if you're talking about federal civil rights law, where that argument may really have teeth, and it's why we've already seen the Biden Justice Department flagging their interest in it, versus if we're talking about constitutional law. Of course, again, you know, you always have to look at who's interpreting the law, not just what it is. And given that we have the Supreme Court that we have with the positions that the court has on abortion, you know, you might wonder if the federal civil rights claim would work either.
Thanks for that call. Mary, I want to follow up on that. We've mostly been focusing on the idea of fetal rights, rights starting at conception. Can you talk more about what these laws coming into place could mean for the rights of women during pregnancy, women of childbearing years? What could this all mean for them?
Well, if abortion is unconstitutional, obviously that's kind of like a supercharged version of abortion just being illegal. And in order, the kind of interesting question then becomes, well, how does a state enforce a law like that, given that abortion medication is easy to come by on the internet, and it can be ordered not only from more progressive states, it can be ordered from outside the United States altogether. So I think what that could mean, and again, we're just beginning to see how this is going to play out, is that people of reproductive age may be surveyed more by law enforcement. We've already seen concerns raised in particular about digital privacy, about how people's online lives could be used to enforce criminal abortion laws. So for example, you know, what are called geofence warrants, like information people can get from your smartphone or your GPS about where you're traveling, information like data you may enter in period trackers, text messages you may enter that are unencrypted, social media posts or direct messages, emails, all of these kinds of reams of digital data, which are already being mined by companies that sell data to targeted advertisers, right? The folks where when you see, you know, a million ads for a vacuum cleaner when you just bought one, if that's being sold to targeted advertisers, it could also be sold or made available to law enforcement. As our caller from Madison suggested, it can affect people's access, and I think we already discussed, to emergency medical treatment for anyone who's pregnant. It can affect access to medications that could be used as abortifacients, including for people who are not pregnant at all, right? I mean, you sometimes see people of reproductive age being denied access to medications for something like lupus on the theory that those drugs could be used as abortifacients. And a lot of this is happening with or without, it's worth emphasizing, the intention of conservative lawmakers, because part of what's happened is that, unlike Wisconsin's law, which is an older law, the newer abortion bans have penalties much harsher than anything we saw in the 19th century, right?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest law professor, Mary Ziegler, from the University of California, Davis, looking at the concept of fetal personhood. Coming up after the news, a look at President Biden's diplomatic visit to the Middle East. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.